All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's begin. We have an amazing class tonight. Trust me. This is an amazing class. I want to begin with a story. Story is, by the way, just for the timestamp, or i.e. the ID stamp on this recording. So this is Curious Tales of the Talmud. This is lesson 3. And it's great to have everyone here. All right, story goes like this. Granddaughter sitting on her grandfather's lap, and he's reading her a bedtime story, and she, as she's listening to the story, she's tenderly stroking his cheeks. And he didn't have like a bushy beard like I have, but he, you know. And she feels his cheeks, and they're wrinkly, and she feels her own cheeks. And they're very smooth, and his cheeks, and her cheeks, and his cheeks, and her cheeks. And finally, as the story goes on, literally, and also in this story of the story, so she speaks up and she says to her grandfather, "Grandpa, did God make you?" And he answers, "Of course, yes, a long time ago." And then a few moments later, she says, "Grandpa, did God make me?" And he says, "Yeah, just a little while ago." And then she thinks for a moment and she says, "You know, Grandpa, God's getting better at it, isn't he?" Smoother and... Yeah. So the reason why I mentioned this joke, first of all, because why not? But also, no, but there is actually a point here. Because sometimes we look back at the past and we look at ourselves. And as we contrast the past, stories of the past with ourselves, we might end up saying, you know, God's getting better at this. Why? I'll tell you why. How many times have we read a story in the Torah, a biblical story, scratched our heads and said, what were they thinking? And that's like the clean version. What were they thinking? Give me some examples of when you might have said in a biblical story, what were they thinking? Give me an example that comes to mind. Yaakov, when? Which part? Which dramatic part?
The same parents, and they were so
But that's like, how did they end up that way? I understand what you said. What were they thinking? Give me some. Get started off where I would then say, we can all say it together. What were they thinking? Give me a what were they thinking moment.
Who's the they? Who's the they?
Whoever the, you tell me who the they is. Does that make sense?
Moses,
but that was a good thing. Give me something negative where you're like, what were they thinking? Come on, hook me up. Somebody give me. Good. What else?
The flood.
What were they thinking? Good. Adam and Eve.
Oh, yeah.
Is my mic on? Right, Adam and Eve. Right, God says, don't eat of the tree. And they're eating the tree. They're eating of the fruit. What were they thinking, right? You have the Jews. Any other things that come to mind? I mean, I got a few. If you're comfortable hearing from me, I'll tell you what I have. All right, so you have Adam and Eve. By the way, the sages tell us, how long do you think they had the mitzvah, the prohibition against eating from the tree? How long? Yeah, no, one before they ate it. In general, how long did they have in total before? Both. I'm actually looking for both. They were created in the sixth hour on Friday, which is like 12 o'clock, between 12 and 1-ish. They only had till Shabbos arrived to not eat of the tree. We're dealing with like a maximum of like 4 or 5 hours. 4 to 6 hours. Within 2 hours, they were chomping. Within 2 hours! And I always say, well, you can't really blame them, because go tell somebody, don't look over there. Whatever you, don't look over there. The first thing you're like, wait, why shouldn't I look over there? And you're like, checking out. He tells them, don't eat of the tree. They're eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But the point is, they were God's handiwork. They only had a few hours to withhold. Only a few hours. They knew they only had a few hours. God says, until Shabbos, don't eat the tree. They could. Within a few hours, they're chomping. The next puzzling story of the Torah. We're going to get to Curious Tales of the Talmud in a second, but this is the way of introducing this concept. Then you have stories like that deal, stories of the Jews that left Egypt. The Exodus generation. Right? There's Generation X, and then there's Generation Exodus. So Generation Exodus, right? They see the plagues. They're experiencing Exodus, splitting of the sea that was mentioned, right? They receive the Torah at Sinai, divine revelation. 40 days later, they're dancing the Hora around a golden calf. You got to be kidding me. What? Let's all together. What were they thinking? Exactly. What were they thinking? All right, let me get the AC on. Here's the point. Here's the point. Lots of stories. What were they thinking? Then you turn later to the books of Scripture. Nevi'im, Ksuvim, the books of the prophets, mainly the books of the prophets. And you read these stories of individuals that were around people, at least, that had divine inspiration, there was prophecy abounding, and yet they're serving idols. There's the Baal worship. There's an idol called the Baal. They keep on serving this Baal to their detriment. They get defeated in wars. God says to the prophets, because you're serving idols, like, okay, we're sorry, and it would last for 10 years, and then it would be back to it again. And it was this cycle, and you asked, and you read it, and you get so frustrated. And you think to yourself, who are these people? What's wrong with them? What were they thinking? All right. Make sense so far? All right. What we're going to do today is kind of figure out, why is it that when we look at the past, it seems like no one can get their act together? It seems like, I'm like, dude, get your act together. Make it happen. You just saw God 40 days before. Stop serving the golden calf. All right. We need to understand what's up with them, what's going on. And I think it's a question that some of us, most of us, maybe all of us have asked at one point or another. It's a totally legitimate question. But more than figuring out tonight what specifically was going on in those stories, more than that, what we're going to do is we're going to be drawing some major life lessons about personal success and failure, judging others, the fine line separating self-confidence and overconfidence. And we'll also be talking about the best way to look at our lives, the best perspective to have about our lives right now. So all of these important lessons, what I would venture to say, life-altering lessons, all of these lessons we're going to be pulling out of tonight's class in the next about hour and 20 minutes. So let's begin. We're going to start at the top with another curious tale of the Talmud. The Talmud, let's see, where we're text 1a on page 94. We'll read it in a moment. It's actually a Mishnah. We're going to start with a Mishnah from Sanhedrin. I'll just to give you a little bit of an intro, the tales that we're going to discuss tonight are not talking about mythical sea voyage tales like in Lesson 1 or tales that speak of God in human terms like in Lesson 2, but rather the main focus, the main story of tonight is regarding a strange dream and a seemingly impossible encounter that spans 1,000 years. We begin with a Mishnah, text 1a. All right, you ready? Ezra, take it away.
Three kings have no portion in the world to come: Jeroboam, Ahab, and Manasseh.
Says the Mishnah in Tractate Sanhedrin, there's a rule, a general rule that says that we each have a portion of the world to come. There is a promise of afterlife and a promise of resurrection, Tchiyat HaMesim. It's fundamental Jewish beliefs. Typically, everyone's involved, everyone's part of the game, everyone's in. Says the Mishnah, there are three kings that are excluded from this. Who are they? Jeroboam, Ahab, and Manasseh. If you want to know their real names in Hebrew, it's Yeravam, Achav, and Menashe. What's their story? So let me tell you a little bit about these three kings. The first one, Jeroboam, or Yeravam. Who was he? Who was Yeravam? It was the days following the passing of King Solomon. So in the history of Jewish kings, you had King Saul. King Saul's throne was taken away and given to King David. And then God promised that the Davidic dynasty, they would rule forever. They would be the ruling family. So you had King Saul, King David, King Solomon, took over for his father, King David. Then when Solomon passed away, his son, Rehoboam, took over. However, he taxed the people brutally. He levied just oppressive taxes on the people. And the people revolted. And they said, we don't want to pay the tax. It's kind of like a state that would secede from the union, or a city or a community that would create their own municipality, their own city. So bottom line is, what happened was it created a fracture amongst the Jewish people. You ever hear the 10 tribes and the 10 lost tribes? You ever wonder, like, what are the 10 lost tribes? Here's what happened. There was a split between the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom was around the area of Jerusalem. Around that area, that's where Solomon's son continued to rule. That was considered the kingdom of Judah. The 10 tribes in the north, they said, we're not paying those taxes. That's it. We're going to create our separate kingdom. Kingdom of Israel. There was the kingdom of Judah, kingdom of Israel. The 2 tribes in the south, including Jerusalem and the temple, and the 10 tribes in the north, they said, we're not paying the taxes. 2 separate kings. 2 separate kings. Later on in history, when who was it? Sanherib, other Babylonian kings and generals and warriors came in and kind of disrupted Jewish life. So that's the 10 lost tribes. They kind of moved those tribes out, and they became lost. We don't really know what happened to those tribes.
What about the tribes of Judah?
Tribes of Judah, they remained intact. They were exiled as well, but they remained.
So what were the tribes?
They were Judah and Benjamin. Judah and Benjamin. Those are the two that remained together. Here's a very important thing. The first king of the northern kingdom was this guy here, Rehoboam. We read about him. Listen to this. It's mind-boggling. What does Rehoboam say? Let's build altars in the north for idolatry, pagan worship, idol worship, altars, temples. Not only that, it gets better. There's a mitzvah in the Torah to go make a pilgrimage to the Holy Temple for the 3 pilgrimage holidays, the Shalosh Regalim, Passover, Shavuot, which is coming up in a week, and Sukkot. Those are the 3 major festivals. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are important, but they're not pilgrimage festivals. The 3 are Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot. It's a mitzvah, every single Jew, to go to Jerusalem and be at the Holy Temple. What does Rehoboam do? Again, he's in the north. He doesn't want anybody going to the south. Why? Because it's a different kingdom, different territory. And in the south, the king of the south, which is a different king, again, they're feuding kings, feuding territories, so that he's the big man on campus, so to speak, down south. The king, Rehoboam, doesn't want anybody going down there to see what's going on. And everybody's saying, hey, wait, there's the temple here. So what does he do? He puts idols along the roads. And he puts guards along the roads. And he blocks the path. He blocks the street. He blocks the roads. No one can get past. And they're all forced to worship idols.
Did he create another temple, though?
Huh?
Didn't he create a temple?
Not an official temple. I mean, they had sacrifices. They created altars, mini temples, but not like a holy temple of Jerusalem. But they created it. Yeah, they had their own thing. But completely idolatry. Comes along the Mishnah, our sages in Avot, it's not here. It says, Rehoboam is an example of somebody that sinned. Not only did he sin, everyone, King Solomon says already that there's no person that only does good and doesn't sin. Someone who sinned and caused others to sin. He caused others to sin. Says the Mishnah here in Sanhedrin, doesn't have a share in the world to come. Bad guy. Alright, he's a bad guy. We read about him. He sounds pretty bad. Jen, you had a question? The Baal, the Asherah, yeah. It's the same ones. The same, calling Yiddish Mishagas, the same idols.
It's called Baal, right?
Baal.
Which is really just Hebrew for master.
Yeah. Yeah. There was the Asherah, which is the feminine tree, force, energy thing. Whatever. Anyway, bottom line is, these idols are worshipped. Achav, 50 years. After Rehoboam's death, comes up this fellow named Achav. Ahab. Who was he married to? Pretty, not so nice lady.
Jezebel.
Izebel. She was, talk about a fan of the Baal. This is that idol. She was like, she created the fan club. She was like Mrs. Baal. And she told her husband, this is what we're into. And so they create, also again, he was also king in the north. Creates altars, creates temples. It's unbelievable what's going on. Not only that, it gets better. Achav is forcing the people to worship idols. He persecutes and kills, he murders prophets that were telling the people not to listen to this guy. He said, you're telling me not to listen? Boom. They had to hide in caves. There's all of these stories about people having to flee Achav and Jezebel. And most, for whatever reason, it's a famous story that Jezebel famously convinced her husband to kill some poor guy who owns a vineyard because she wanted the vineyard. He wanted the vineyard and he didn't want to get the vineyard. He said, kill this guy. Relatively, I mean, they did a lot of killing, so this is just one story, but it's very poignant the way it's written in Scripture. You kill a guy because he wants his vineyard. He doesn't want to give it to you. Like, anyway, bottom line is another pretty bad guy. So the mission says, no share in the world to come. Who's Manasseh? Manasseh. Who's the third king? He was a king, listen to this. He was a king who ruled toward the end of the first temple era. About 50 to 100 years before the end of the second temple era. So just to give you some perspective. Yeravam, the first king that we mentioned, ruled in the 8th century BCE. So we're talking about 2,800 years ago. Achav ruled in the 7th century BCE. Manasseh ruled in the south, in the kingdom of Judah, over the temple, in the 6th and 5th centuries BCE. So we're talking about 2,500, 2,600 years ago. He ruled for 55 years. Let's actually read his description in text 1b. You know what, Ezra, you got a really small one. Continue with the story as it's described, or the bio of Manasseh as described in Kings 2.
Hezekiah destroyed. He erected altars to the Baal. He made a worship tree as Ahab, the king of Israel, had made. And he worshipped and prostrated himself with all the heavenly hosts. He built pagan altars in the holy temple, though God had said, in Jerusalem I will establish my name. He also erected altars to all the heavenly hosts in the two courtyards of the temple.
Keep it going, yeah.
Manasseh led the nation astray and caused them to do more evil than that committed by the nations that God had destroyed before the Israelites. God relayed a message through his servants, the prophets. Because Manasseh committed these abominations, he has done more evil than all the Amorites who were before him, and he caused Judah to sin with his idols. Therefore, the God of Israel says, behold, I will bring such a calamity on Jerusalem and Judah, that the ears of all who hear it will tingle.
He was the king over the southern kingdom, over the temple. He builds altars for the idols. Where? In the holy temple in Jerusalem. In the base of Middash. It's a chutzpah. Chutzpah. Idolatry. The Baal. In the base of Middash itself. That's like, yeah, anyway, so that's a chutzpah. So what happens is God says, that's it, I'm going to destroy Jerusalem, destroy the temple, and that's it. And 50 years after he passed away, the temple was destroyed. It was the first temple. Now, it's important to understand who this guy was. He was the son of Chizkiyahu, Hezekiah. Chizkiyahu was a righteous king, perhaps the most righteous king. Our sages cannot stop extolling the virtue of his father, Chizkiyahu. He cleaned up all of the idolatry in the land, in Israel. He cleaned out, there were always remnants of idolatry, he cleaned it up. Comes along his son, puts it back. Listen to this, it gets even better. Chizkiyahu, Hezekiah, had a vision. He was also a prophet. He had a vision that his son would be evil. So guess what he did? Guess what he did? He didn't get married. He has a vision that his son will be evil. So guess what? He doesn't get married. comes along the prophet Yeshayo, Isaiah. Isaiah says to him, he gets sick. Hezekiah gets sick. He's sick. He's on his deathbed. Comes along the prophet Yeshayo and he says, you know why you're sick? A prophet can say this. He says, because you didn't get married. You didn't have kids. God wants you to have kids. He says, but I saw a vision that my son would be evil. He's like, you can't play God. God wants you to get married and have a child. So he says, on one condition, if you give me your daughter, he says to Isaiah. Isaiah says, fine. He marries Yeshayo, the prophet's daughter. They have a son. Son is Manasseh. And he's evil. Just like he had been foretold. Gets even worse. During Manasseh's lifetime, Yeshayo, his grandfather, was still saying prophecy. And he said some pretty bad stuff about Manasseh. If you keep on serving idols, if you keep on creating these altars for idols, temple will be destroyed, bad things are going to happen, it's not going to be good. Guess what Manasseh does? Kills his own grandfather. What? Story goes that he was hiding, Isaiah was hiding from Manasseh, from the king, up in a tree. And Manasseh comes down, he sees his tzitzis hanging down. He takes a sword, he cuts the branch, and Isaiah was killed. Manasseh is is a terrible, terrible fellow. All right? Mishnah says, these three kings have no share in the world to come. Seems pretty straightforward. And now we get to our curious tale of the Talmud. Talmud, Tractate, Sanhedrin, text number 2. This is the key text of tonight. Right here is the story. Again, we're going to read the story, and the story should bewilder us. And we're going to analyze it, and we're going to break it down, and then we're going to put it back together again so that it makes sense. Let's take it away. Text 2, Adina Malka. Take it away.
Rav Ashi once completed his lecture just as he reached the Mishnah regarding the three kings.
Again, the Mishnah of the three kings is the one that we just read. These three kings have no share in the world to come. So one day he was teaching Torah, and he got up to this point. He didn't teach, he got right up to here. Continue.
Tomorrow he told the students we will commence the lecture with a discussion about our colonies. That night, Manasseh appeared to Rav Ashi in his dream. You refer to us as your colleagues and the colleagues of your father. Answer then this halakhic question. From where are you supposed to break the loaf of bread over which you recite the Hamotzi blessing? You do not know, Rav Ashi responded. You have not learned the simple law, Manasseh chided him. Yet you have the nerve to call us your colleagues. Teach me this halakha, Rav Ashi begged, and tomorrow I will teach it in the academy in your name. From the part of the loaf that was fully baked before the rest, Manasseh responded. If you are so wise, Rav Ashi wondered, why did you worship idols? Were you there with me, Manasseh answered. Were you there with me, Manasseh answered, you would have lifted the hem of your cloak and run after me to worship them. The next day, Rav Ashi said to his students, today we will commence the lecture with a discussion about the great ones.
So he changed, at the end of the story, he changed from calling them the colleagues, chevraya, colleagues, to great ones. Due to the vision of Manasseh, the king, appearing to him at night and telling him this law. This is the story as recorded in the Talmud. That's it. This is the unedited, this is the story the way it appears. Ready for some questions? I'm sure you have some questions of your own. Let me open up with this question. Before we ask the questions, I want to give you a historical context of who Rav Ashi was. Who was Rav Ashi? Rav Ashi and Manasseh. We know who Manasseh was, the king, lived in the 5th century BC. Rav Ashi lives in the 5th century C of our common era, like 1500 years ago, 1600 years ago. Rav Ashi was a Torah scholar par excellence. He was a Talmudist. He, in fact, ran the academy in Babylonia in a place called Sura, the great Talmudic academy in Sura. For 60 years, he was the head of the academy. He was the original compiler of the Talmud itself. In fact, without Rav Ashi, we wouldn't have this course. purest tales of the Talmud. There will be no Talmud without Rav Ashi. Unless you say somebody else would have done it. But bottom line is, Rav Ashi puts together the first draft and was a prime editor, the major editor of the Talmud. There were others that helped him, but he's the first one that put it together. This Rav Ashi. And then you have, so in this corner, Rav Ashi, the great Torah scholar of his time, head of the academy, the redactor of the Talmud. In the other corner, who do you have? You have Menashe, the king that we spoke about before. If you ask me, Menashe is lucky that Rav Ashi is calling him his colleague. And not something more derogatory. And he's complaining, he's kvetching to him in a dream at night. You called me your colleague, I know this law that you don't know. I mean, what's going on here? That's the basic question. And then now we can... You with me on the question so far? Question? Yeah? Question kind of, yeah? Okay. A few details of the story to ponder. Number one. When we pick apart the story, we've got a lot more questions. Here are some questions. And first of all, does anybody have any questions on the story?
Well, yeah.
Go.
I want to understand, were you there with me, you would have run after idols too. Like, I would like to know if the whole country would.
That's the upshot. That's his point. And based on all of this, now you know that if you were there, you would be no better. You would be as bad as I was. Where does that come from? Good. All right. Good. That's a good question. Good. That's that. To me, I have six questions, and that's just scratching the surface. I have six questions. That's my last question. You're right. Should I tell you the other questions that I have on the story? Here's some other questions that I have in my notes. Number one, why did Menashe assume that Rav Ashi did not know this law? He knew that he didn't know the law. That's why, imagine if he said, hey, where do you break the bread? And the guy's like, dude, I know this. He'd be like, oh, sorry, back to sleep you go. Let me just mosey on back to someone else's dreams. Again, understand that Menashe comes to him in the middle of the night to say, I bet you don't know this law. And he doesn't. How did he know he didn't know this law? Question. He knew he didn't know this law. How did he know that? Question number one. Question number two. Why indeed did Rav Ashi not know this law? Why didn't he know? Where do you break the bread from for the hamotzi when you say the blessing over the bread? From where do you break? How come he didn't know the law? That's question number two. Question number three. What does this law have to do at all with the relation between Rav Ashi and Menashe? Like, what does one have to do with the other? Like, just because you don't know this law, therefore what? Like, what does the law have to do with the discussion? He's saying that the Mishnah says you don't have a share in the world to come, so he calls them colleagues. So he's like, yeah, but you don't know this law. What does the law have to do with the relationship? What's the meaning of Menashe, is the next question, fourth question. What's the meaning of Menashe's strange answer about the law itself? In other words, it's you break bread where it baked first. How do you know where it baked first? Like, who's like looking into the, like, how do you know which part? Was anybody wondering this? Like, how do you know which?
I thought it was a separate piece of bread. Separate piece of dough or something.
I thought it meant like when you push the loaf in, like one end goes in first or something.
I don't know, but like which, but you have a loaf in your oven. I'm reading it simply. I don't know, call me too simple, but you have a loaf in your oven. You pull it out. Where do you open it? Where do you cut it open? Where it baked first. Now what do I do?
The crust.
The crust, the end. I guess the end, but like, how do you know? Maybe the other end. How do you know which end? I mean, I guess if it's an enigmatic answer. It's an enigmatic law. How do you know he didn't know the law? How come he didn't know the law? What does the law have to do with the price of tea in China, or in this context, is it a law? What does it mean? How do you know where it baked first? And why is Rav Ashi, he says, you know this law. Remember what he says here. He says, if you are so wise, why do you worship idols? What does one have to do with the other? Oh, now that Menashe proves that he knows the law, he says, so knew you even knew where the bed, where you how you break bread? How could you serve idols? With that, that's like, that really gets you wondering, how could you serve idols and do all those things because you knew the law about baking bread? Like, what does that have to do with that? And finally, the final question, which we said first, is why does Menashe assume that Rav Ashi, had he been with him, would have been running to serve idols? Why? Good questions. Again, we could go deeper, but bottom line is the story, if we take one step back, forget about the details of the questions. Bottom line is the story leaves us a bit puzzled. What's the dialogue about? What's this law of the bread about? Why did he serve idols? Why is it surprising to serve idols? Why would Rashi serve idols? What's going on here? These are the questions on the table. By the end of tonight's class, you will see how this story has so much depth and so much meaning, practical relevance and meaning in your life today. We're going to get right back to it. Yeah.
Where does Menashe come from with knowledge to question?
Ravashi. Oh, good, good. That's a very good question. Seems that he was also a scholar. Seems.
He was a scholar of the Talmud, and yet he still...
He was not a Talmudic scholar. He lived 1,000 years before. Remember, he lived 500 BCE. Ravashi is living 500 CE. You have a nearly 1,000-year gap. This guy is transcending time or whatever, or from the whatever afterlife he's in, and he's communicating with Ravashi, who he felt dissed him by calling him colleague. He's like, colleague? I'll prove to you that I can school you. I can teach you something that you don't even know. And he picks out this law upon which he says, well, how could you serve... Again, and that's where the whole dialogue comes in. But it's 1,000 years. He's not a Talmudic scholar. He was an ancient king. But he's appearing to the Talmudic scholar in the editor of the Talmud in the dream, in this dream. And he's chastising him.
Was there actually a halachic law relating to this that he mentioned?
It seems like there was something about the bread that you break... Okay, so we're going to get into what does this mean. All right, we're going to get into it.
When Rav Avi referred to him as a colleague, you mean that woke him out of his sleep?
Yeah, he's like, why I ought to come to you in a dream and tell you what's going on? Who's talking about me like that? Yeah, that's exactly what happened. But the question is specifically, what does the dialogue mean, the back and forth? And again, I asked for detailed questions. You don't have to worry about the details of the question. You have all the questions straight. As long as you have the explanation, which we'll get to, which we're going to start building right now. So let's start building the answer, the perspective. So in order to understand the narrative, we have to take a deeper look, much, much deeper, at the entire historical narrative. And what we'll see when we look deeper is that the big idea that Menashe wants to bring out, this is going to be like the takeaway as well. The big idea, the central point that Menashe the king is trying to relate to Ravashi the Talmudist 1,000 years later, or is that one cannot judge without knowing what went on. You cannot judge someone else without knowing what is going on at that time, at that place, in the context. That's the central point. What does that mean, though, specific in this context? That's clearly what Menashe is saying. It's like, and that's the final point. If you were with me, you'd be right there. You're sitting 1,000 years later and judging me. If you were with me, you would have been doing that. The question is, why? How does he know? What does it do with the bread? That's what we're going to get to right now. So let's talk about the pilgrimage. I mentioned it before. 3 times a year, the Jews would make the pilgrimage. There's a mitzvah. Shalosh Regalim, 3 festivals. Be in Jerusalem, show up at the temple, take a look at what the Talmud says. Text number 3. Jan, take it away. Page 99. Very significant text. Text 3.
Just as one came to the Holy Temple to be seen by God, so too one came to see God.
There's a mitzvah to show up and be seen by God. God wants you to be there. I'm looking out for you. Hey, Ari, how are you? Hey, how's it going? All right, so God wants to see us. God wants to see us. Says the Talmud in Chagigah, just as we came to the temple for God to see us, we came, the person came to see God as well. This is a powerful, powerful idea. What does it mean to see God? In fact, question for discussion right there on page 99. What does it mean to see God? So seeing God means to perceive God. Seeing does not necessarily mean that you're seeing God. God doesn't have a form, as we said last week, doesn't have a shape. What does it mean that we see God? It means that you perceive the reality of God with... It's like you're seeing it with your eyes. So let me explain what that means. Our sages tell us, it's also recorded in the Mishnah in Tractate Avot as follows. Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, it says like this in the 5th chapter. There were 10 miracles that happened every single day in the temple. 10 miracles that happened on a daily basis. When you walked into the temple, you saw the miraculous happen. Whether it was that the fire that burned consistently, there was a fire that came from on high that burned consistently, or whether it was the smoke that rose from the incense and from the sacrifices that no wind could alter. Like that, no pun intended. There was this single column of smoke that went up to the heavens that would never move, would never shift, no matter what wind. There were various other miracles, etc. The point is, our sages tell us that there were these opportunities to perceive God. It's almost like when you, what does it mean that you see God? It doesn't have to be that you, again, it's not literally that you're seeing God. You're seeing God's actions. You're seeing what God, it's like, say it again? Well, no, it's more than belief, because belief you can do anywhere. But seeing God happens in the temple. What does that mean? It means like this. You know, if you see this projector, so you know that there is, you can see that there's electricity in it that's powering it. How do you see it? Because it's shining. So you don't actually see the electricity, but you see the effect of the electricity, so you know it's there. You know it's there. It's not that you believe it's there. See, belief is like, I believe it's there. But knowing is something else. Perceiving, it's almost like you see it. It's pretty much you see it. Like somebody's alive, so you know that there's that their heart's beating, that their mind is working. How do you know? You see their brain. You don't see their brain, but you see it because you... All right. So the idea is that the Jews of that generation had the ability to see God. But it's even better than that. In addition to seeing God in the miracles, this is a very important point. In addition to seeing God in the miracles, they had the ability of that. Our sages tell us they had the ability in that generation to see God in the everyday as well. It's one thing to see God in the miraculous. It's quite another to see God in the natural and everyday in nature itself. They had the ability to perceive God in nature, in the natural order of things, as things carried on, as things kind of as everyday life unfolded. They had the ability to see God. What does that mean to see God? It means to recognize how everything is driven by a divine force. What we would call maybe today Mother Nature or whatever, they recognized as being powered by God. More than that, not only did they see God as a general force in life, but they were able to perceive God and God's hand in every specific detail in life. In other words, they were able to see specifically how every detail in life was created by God, was driven by God, was put there for a reason. Now, did everyone have this perception? Not necessarily. But this perception was available at that time. There were people, there was prophecy, and people were prophets, people saw God, they had visions, people were very spiritual at the time. So, with the destruction of the temple and the ensuing exile, this spiritual sensitivity was lost. This is what's documented. They had this spiritual sensitivity. They were able to see God in the everyday and all the details. And then when the temple was destroyed, that sensitivity was lost. And nowadays, we don't see God. We don't see God in the details. I.e., we don't see how God puts everything, orchestrates everything for a benefit or for a certain purpose. We don't see that off the bat. In fact, we're lucky to see God, any form of God at all. Sometimes it's like we don't see any sign of God. And again, here's the important point. Even today, even when we see God in a sense, even when we kind of feel like, well, God was involved or God is involved, it's hard to see how every detail reflects the master plan. Or specifically, I'll give you an example. It's hard to see today, you know, when you're thinking about where should I live, where should I move, what job should I take, who should I marry? I mean, all of these types of questions, it's hard to see the divine plan. We don't see the divine plan. We kind of make our own choices. We go by what our gut tells us. We go by intuition. We go by what our friends, you know, our friends help us. But to see God's plan, to see everything mapped out, to be privy to the script, we're not. In those times, in those days, in the times of the temple, it seems the idea is that they had more access to the master plan, where they were able to see more of the details and have that reality speak to them. So, bottom line is, in the temple times, they had a heightened state of godly perception. They saw God, which is what our sages mean when they say, just like one came to be seen, they also saw God. All right. All of this helps us understand the exchange between Menashe and Ravashi. With that introduction, we can now jump straight back into the story. Remember the story, Menashe appears to Ravashi in a dream, and he starts asking him about bread. And what's he asking him? From where do you break bread? When you're reciting the Hamotzi blessing, the blessing over the bread, where do you break it open? What does that mean? I'm going to share with you what's been explained about this story. In the sages, we have here text 4 is a little bit about it, but let me share with you the idea first outside, and then we're going to read a little bit inside. Menashe first comes to Ravash, and he says as follows, do you say a blessing when you eat bread? Do you recite a blessing? He says, yeah. He says, do you recognize that the bread that you eat comes from God? Ravashi says, yeah. Yeah. It's a blessing from God. I know. It's bread, but it's a blessing. It didn't just come from the stores. Back then they didn't have stores. It's a blessing. He says, okay. Do you recognize specifically all of the details that went into the creation of the bread? Do you recognize the exact specific purpose of the bread in your life? Do you recognize God's purpose in every single moment, every step of the way? Do you recognize that? Ravashi says, no. I don't see that. Menashe says as follows. He says to him, tell me, where do you break the bread? You tell me that God created the loaf of bread, right? The loaf of bread comes from God. But where specifically? Which part specifically? Do you see God in the general or can you see God in the details? And Ravashi answers, I can't see God in the details. I don't have that vision. I don't have that perception. We see God. We have faith in God. We believe in God. That God generally does this, does that, does the other. That God generally gives us life, gives us blessing, but specifically, the specifics of the blessing, the specifics of the gifts, that, again, the bread is synonymous with physical bounty, with physical life, with our life. Specifically, what is the blessing? What's the nature of the blessing? How is it a blessing? What are we to utilize the blessing for that we typically don't see? Ravashi says he doesn't know. He doesn't have that clarity of vision. Menashe answers Ravashi, Menashe turns to Ravashi and says, you should know, I know where to break bread from. What does that mean? What he's telling him is as follows. You don't have that vision, but I did. In my lifetime, when I was king, in the temple era, I was able to see exactly which part of the bread was baked first. What does that mean? Right, because his answer is, so he says, Ravashi, tell me, where do you break the bread first? Where it was baked first. What does that mean, baked first? To be able to discern exactly which path in life God intends for you to take. Which path in life you're meant to take. What God meant by this detail, by that creation, by the other creation, to know exactly, to see the script in front of you. To know all of the choices and to understand the significance of all the choices. Menashe says, I saw that. So when you look at a piece of bread, when you look at a loaf of bread and you say, well, God gave us this blessing, I look at it and say, God gave me specifically this part of the bread to eat right now to start with it first. Menashe said, I had that vision, you didn't. I had that vision. You do not have that vision. What's the point of him saying this? What's the point? He's trying to bring out that there was a much greater awareness of God in his times than in the times of Ravashi. Let's now segue over to text 4. We're building this out as a puzzle. Text 4, page 99. Sandy, take it away. Page 99, text 4. Rav Tzadok of Lublin gives this answer.
Naso is in effect asking, do you perceive in detail how God provides bread for all flesh? If yes, you would certainly know which part of the loaf God has prepared for you to eat first, on which you should recite the Hamotzi blessing.
Do you see God in generalities, or do you see God in the details? Do you see God's presence generally, God created the world, or specifically? Do you see God in the loaf in general, or the specific part of the bread that baked first, i.e. that's meant for you to consume first? It's like somebody asks, somebody asks themselves or turns to God in prayer and says, "Tell me, God, what should I do? Where should I go? What do you want? What do you have in store for me?" Typically, there's no answer that comes booming down. Manasseh said, "I had that clarity. I had that clarity. I knew which part of the bread was intended for me to eat first, and which bite second, and which bite third. I had that vision." Again, this is Manasseh, the evil king, talking. Because in the temple times, this was the clarity of vision that people had. They saw God. Yeah.
So he could see God in details.
Yeah. Guess what Ravashi's next question is? What does Ravashi ask? That's exactly the follow-up question. Not, it doesn't make sense before. The fact that he told him Allah, what does that do with his spiritual virtue? He told him Allah by breaking bread, so how could you serve idols? What's the connection? He knew the law, but he still served idols. Now that you understand that when he said, "I know how to break bread," means that I saw God in the details, now the question thunders. If you are so wise, Ravashi wondered. And what does wise mean? Chachma. If you're able to see, also chachma means sight, the power of vision, spiritual vision. If you're able to see God so clearly, why'd you worship idols? Now it makes no sense. Somebody's an idolater, someone serves idols, so in general, let's say, it's hard for us to understand, so we'll say generally it makes no sense. But Manasseh comes to him in a dream and says that, as spiritually enlightened as you think you are, you have nothing on us. You have nothing on me, because you can't see God in the details. I was able to. So now the question really becomes, so why, you of all people, how could you serve idols? How could you put up altars in the temple? How could you be an idolater? How could you force others to serve idols? To which Manasseh replies, what's the answer? If you were there with me, you would also do it. That's what we're going to get to right now. He says, if you were there, in other words, if you had the same spiritual vision that I had, if you saw God as clearly as I did, as we did, you would also be running after the Baal, after the Asher, after all of the idols in the world. Why? That's his premise. His premise is, first of all, you should know the clarity of vision. We saw God, you didn't see God. You don't see God, he says. Tells Ravashi. Ravashi says, "No, so if you saw God, why are you serving idols?" He says, if you saw God also on that level, you would also serve idols. How does that make sense? We're going to get there in a second, yeah?
Maybe there's something about that clarity that's not
obvious. We're going to try to understand it. I'm going to give you two ways to understand this, yeah? Right? So how come, what's his deal? What's his dealio?
So we might as well serve idols if that's what...
Oh, you're saying that way. Yeah, we don't believe, by the way, in a fatalistic type of divine... We don't believe in a fatalistic view of life, which means that even if something is predestined, that something negative happened, Judaism says categorically that a person has the power to avert, to change that. Even if there's a negative prophecy... The rule of thumb is, the Talmud teaches us, on other sources it says this, that if there's a positive prophecy, it will happen. A negative one could be averted. Could be changed through prayer, through whatever it is. Here's the point though. Manasseh says, it's because we had the clarity, because I saw God, that we were serving idols. Had you been there, you would have been part of the fray as well. Why? How? How does it make sense? To understand this, we have to introduce another strange Talmudic text. Another strange story. You ready? Text number 5. Text number 5. Let me give you a little bit of background. The background is, here's the context. The story in text 5 takes place at the beginning of the second temple era. So the first temple is destroyed. They're in exile for 70 years. Come back, a portion of the people come back from Babylonia, they come back to Jerusalem, come back to Israel, they come back to Jerusalem, they're about to rebuild the second temple. There's a gathering of the sages, and this is what happens at the gathering. Sarah, take it away.
They cry aloud to God. What was their cry? Others say, Rabbi Yochanan said, this was their cry. Woe, woe, it is this temptation for idolatry that has caused the destruction of the holy temple, the burning of the sanctuary, the killing of all the righteous, and the expulsion of Israel from her land. And this temptation is still dancing among us. You have surely given it to us because of its benefit, we want neither it nor its benefit.
They said to God, we don't want this temptation. Continue.
They fasted 3 days and 3 nights, whereupon the temptation for idolatry was surrendered to them. The Savior said, because this is a time of grace, let us pray to also be rid of the temptation of sexual transgression. They prayed, and this temptation too was handed over to them. 3 days later, they searched the entire land of Israel for a fresh egg, but there were none.
Going to get there and say the last two paragraphs we're going to explain shortly. Let's focus on the initial part of the story. The sages, they're about to rebuild the second temple. They know that the first temple was destroyed. Why? Because of idolatry. And they recognize that it's in the air. They're about to build the second temple, and they can smell that people are about to serve idols again. They can sniff it out. And so the sages get together and they turn to God and they say, please, Master of the universe, take this away from us. For 3 days they fasted and they prayed, whereupon the temptation for idolatry was surrendered to them. Let's understand what this means. The sages knew that if idolatry was still going to happen, they would have the same fate as before, and the temple would be destroyed, and things would not be good. And so they said to God as follows. They said, eliminate the drive for idolatry. Eliminate it, and it'll be for our benefit. Now, I have to introduce one other point. This happens, interestingly enough, at the very same time that the era of prophecy ends. There was an era of prophecy for many, many years, many centuries. There were, as I mentioned before, many prophets, people who saw God, who God communicated through, etc. There weren't just certain prophets, there were many prophets. The Talmud says, the end of the era of prophecy, or the era of prophecy ended right at this time, right before the second temple was built. So think about these two pieces of information. The era of prophecy is ending, and the temptation for idolatry is also ending. What's the significance? What's the message here? What's the connection?
Question.
Yeah.
The word surrender.
Yeah.
It appears that it's being handed over to them, not taken away from them.
Handed over to them, it's destroyed. It's gone. It's gone. In fact, the reason why you and I don't feel the urge to serve idols is because of this. Yeah, that's what it means. Forget about the translation. Don't worry about the translation. That's what it means. But look at this. The temptation for idolatry is eradicated at the same time that there's a cessation of prophecy. Here's the question. What's the connection between the two? Here's what has been suggested by Jewish sage and Jewish wisdom. The simple answer, I'm going to give you two answers. I said before, two perspectives. The simple answer is that the greater a positive force is, the greater the negative force is to counterbalance it. In other words, in life, God created a world where good, the drive for good and the drive for evil need to be perfectly counterbalanced. They need to be perfectly balanced. Why? To provide for truly free choice. Imagine, if you will, a world. Understand what I'm saying here. Imagine a world where the temptation for idolatry is eradicated, but prophecy is still around. Is that an equally balanced world? Imagine you saw God and you had no temptation for any other service. So what's everyone going to be doing? Serving God. Is there free choice in that service? No. You see God, that's what you know, that's what you perceive. So it's not free choice. That's why there has to be this perfect balance. If we're taking away the temptation for idolatry, we also have to take away this heightened vision, this heightened awareness of God. Because if you have the awareness of God and no temptation for idolatry, makes it too easy. Conversely, if you take away prophecy and keep the temptation for idolatry, what happens? Again, imagine. You can't see God and you have this powerful drive for idolatry. What's everyone going to be doing?
Worshipping idols.
It has to be perfectly balanced. Again, this is why, historically, our sages tell us that it was at the very same time that prophecy ended, that this intense drive for idolatry also ended. Take a look at text number 6. Raquel, would you please read text number 6, page 101? God says, King Solomon in Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, he says as follows, Ezelu mazel selokim, Hashem created a perfectly balanced world. Good, the opportunity, the drive toward good, and the opportunity and drive for the opposite of good. Everything perfectly balanced so that no one can complain. You can't say you stack the deck one way or the other. It's too easy, it's too hard. No, it's going to be balanced. We're in an era where there's lots of prophecy, there's also a major drive for idolatry. Said, now we can understand Menashe. Menashe's dialogue with Rav Ashi. Menashe says, again, the king, the idolatrous king, comes to the sage 1,000 years later in a dream, and what does he tell him? He says, listen here. You wonder how we could serve idols. You can't relate to it. You know why you can't relate to it? Because you don't have that temptation. You know why you don't have the temptation? Because you can't have the temptation. If you had that temptation, if you had that burning drive to serve idols like we have, there would be no end, there would be no breaks to that. We at least had prophecy to somehow buffer that temptation. But you, now that there's no prophecy, if you had that same drive, you'll be toast. Even we were toast half the time. But you for sure, without prophecy and with the same drive. He says, if you were living in the same era as us, you'd be running after. You know why? Because we had this powerful drive for idolatry that you can't even imagine. And the reason why you don't have it is because of the story in the Talmud. Because the sages at the beginning of the temple, the Second Temple era, they eradicated the drive for idolatry. So you can't relate to a drive that you don't know. Go relate to a drive of banging your head against the wall. You don't have the drive. You don't have that temptation. They had a drive to serve idols. That was there. Why did they have that drive? Because they saw God. So if you see God, everyone's going to be at tzaddik. Everyone's going to be perfect. So they also had to have a counterbalancing that, a temptation to go the other way. That was a powerful drive. As powerful as their vision of God was an equally powerful drive to worship an idol. Now that we have no vision of God, we also don't have the things. That's what Menashe was telling Rav Ashi. Does it make sense? The dialogue, yes, sort of.
But the king still had a responsibility to make a choice.
Correct. He's not absolving himself of the choice. What he's saying is, you can't judge me for my choice. Why? Because wherever we are, big scale, small scale, we all have that balance, and none of us ever choose perfectly the right thing. I mean, Rav Ashi was... The truth is, he didn't know. He didn't know that Rav Ashi would have for sure served idols. But here's the thing. Neither did Rav Ashi know that he wouldn't. There's no way for him to know with assurance that he wouldn't have served idols had he had that yetzer hara, that drive towards serving idols, toward idolatry. He did it. He never... Menashe's point in the dream was, listen, you see God in the details? No. You don't see God, and therefore you don't have the corresponding drive for idolatry. Because you don't have the drive for idolatry, you can't relate to us who ran after idols. If you were there, you might have also done it. How do you know? How do you sit back 1,000 years later, Monday morning quarterbacking, and saying, well, you shouldn't have served idols. Wonderful. You don't have the temptation. What do you know of serving idols? When was the last time you wanted to serve an idol? Right? I know in our times we also have other forms of idols. Whatever. We're talking about straight up building an altar and serving an idol. We don't have the temptation. Most of us. It was taken away. So Menashe is saying, you can't judge me. Straight up, you can't judge me. This is all the simple explanation. We're going to go much deeper. Right now. Yeah. In a moment.
I don't know if this is another class
or something.
Sure. And he wanted them to have free choice. And then every time, and they have no, you know, they're innocent. They don't know what they're doing, theoretically. You know, every time they make the wrong choice, then they get severely punished, and they ask why, and God says, because I said so.
Punishment, I don't like punishment. Let's not talk about punishment.
Cut off his afterlife.
Okay, well, hold on. We'll see the epilogue. What happened at the end with Menashe? Don't worry, we're gonna get there soon. At 9:25, we'll get there. Hold on. We have 23 minutes to get there. Hold on. We'll see what happened. What actually happened at the end with Menashe? We reclaim him at the end. Don't worry. Things are not as bad as it looks right now. Here's the. Say it again. Yeah. Well, that's why. Right. So on the simple level of action. But I understand one thing. This answers, by the way. Remember we started the class by saying, like, what were they thinking? Adam and Eve. They saw God. They were in the Garden of Eden. What were they doing? You understand now? The greater you are, the stronger your temptation is the other way. Understand this. No one is created without the balance. The greater you are, and the more one could say, what were you thinking? The more you should know one thing. Inside them, they have a much more powerful drive the other way than you can imagine. Why? Because they have a positive drive that's so powerful. Again, any individual that is tremendously spiritually sensitive at the same time has a tremendously powerful pull the other direction. It doesn't absolve anyone. It doesn't absolve the person of making that choice. It doesn't justify it. The bottom line, it is what it is. When you look at Adam and Eve and you say, how could they have sinned? Created by God. God's handiwork. We're taking a different angle now. It's not they didn't know better. It's that they had a tremendous drive to eat from the apple. To eat from the tree. It wasn't an apple. Whatever. To eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They had a tremendous drive. But how could they have such a drive if they were such pure? Exactly. Because they were so holy, they had a correspondingly devious drive the other direction. It has to be equally balanced. As Zed, Lu'umma, Zed, also Lakim. God makes one opposite the other. The scales have to be balanced. So if someone is spiritually gifted, if Adam and Eve see God and they're in the Garden of Eden, not Eden. If they're in the Garden of Eden, you know, hanging out with God, they also have to have a tremendous desire to go the other way. And they failed. It doesn't absolve anyone of the guilt of failing, but the bottom line is we can understand at least that they faced a challenge that we cannot relate to because none of us have the same spiritual sensitivity that they had. Menashe says to Ravashi, you don't have the same spiritual sensitivity that I had, and therefore you don't have the same temptation that I had. If you had the same temptation, you might have been also running to idolatry. But bottom line is, you can't judge me. That's the simple understanding. Let me go one step deeper, and this will, I hope that this will like, and that's somehow a good thing. All right, so what's the deeper idea? It's not just that if somebody has a greater spiritual prowess, if someone is gifted spiritually, they have a correspondingly intense desire the other way. In other words, it's corresponding to balance that. It's not just simply that. It's much deeper. It's that the temptation is actually a distortion. In other words, the temptation in a negative direction is a distortion of the positive drive. Bless you. In other words, I'm going to actually explain it. It's because Menashe and his ilk saw God that they needed idols. Why? They saw God, and that was good. They enjoyed that. They enjoyed spiritual experiences so much that they became addicted to spiritual experiences to the point that they had to create spiritual experiences that were illegal. They created banned spiritual experiences because they were so, for lack of a better term, addicted to the spiritual experience. They saw God, they took pleasure in the spiritual experience. And because of that, they sought to replicate that through idolatry. We have to wait for the proper time to come to the pilgrimage, whatever. We're going to do it right now. We're going to build an altar. We're going to offer sacrifice to a foreign god. Something to get them that spiritual satisfaction. Does it make sense? No.
But it sounds like, you know, if you're sort of about God,
Exactly. If you're about God, you're about idols also. Menashe is saying, we were so spiritually sensitive, we ran to idols. Why? One leads to the other. Doesn't have to and it shouldn't, but it did for him. It led, we were sensitive to the godly experience, we were sensitive, so we also wanted a corresponding experience in the dark side. Yeah. You don't like this.
Saying that,
have the spiritual experience. God has no influence. It's just an experience.
One's a pure experience and one's an illegal experience. But the bottom line is, it's somewhat of a spiritual experience. They were so, they love that experience so much. They love that high.
But God is different.
I know that it's radically different. I know that idolatry.
The question of radically different was God. What were they seeing in God? Or what were they seeing that made them feel that they were in tune with God? Was it a one-way street? God didn't respond in any way?
You know, I mean, this when you think about it in these terms, listen. Again, it's hard for us to relate to this and to the flip side. You know, it's hard for us, we who don't have immense pleasure from divine experiences, find it hard to understand what that means, and also we find it hard to understand what it means to then seek that, to replicate that in other forms, shapes, and sizes with idols. We don't know what that means, but we do have a way of understanding it in the context, and that's the second half of the Talmudic story. Remember what else they try to do? After they got rid of the temptation for idolatry, remember what else they try to get rid of? Right? Sensual experiences that are not in the right place. So they said, people are out of control. So we gotta curb that pleasure. And guess what happened? There were no eggs. No eggs. In other words, procreation ends. It's not healthy. You have to have that. So they said, okay, fine, that we can't do. But understand that the Talmud is not just giving us a cute end at the end of the story that this didn't work. The Talmud, there's actually a conceptual parallel. Think about it. Sensual experiences are pleasurable. Because they are, people therefore sometimes seek it in unhealthy places. Illegal places, immoral places, whatever. Because it's a pleasurable experience, so therefore people seek it in places that are not always the healthiest. What the Talmud is saying is the same thing with the people back in the day who had powerful drives for idolatry. They were sensitive. They got pleasure from a spiritual experience. And so they sought those experiences in other forms that weren't so healthy all the time. Some people did, at least. Does it make sense? Understanding what it means to have, so Menashe says you can't relate to it. So you ask me, how do I relate to it? It's hard to relate to it because we don't have that experience, but we can understand it. It's like,
so is this not similar to what you spoke, that when the Mashiach comes, all of these things will resolve themselves? Is that not equivalent to what Menashe had in his relationship with God?
What Menashe had was an intense awareness of God, of spirituality, and pleasure in that experience, in that spiritual awareness. Because of that, he sought that high, that hit, in places that weren't healthy, in places that in a sense destroyed. It's no different than infidelity. I mean, then it's no different than infidelity. It's to the detriment of that of the healthy relationship. You're seeking that physical experience somewhere else. He said, I was seeking spiritual experience, that same type of spiritual intimacy in other places, even though it was coming at the detriment of. But we were so obsessed with that, that's where we were. So it's not only, again, just to take a step back and see the bigger picture. It's not just that, the general rule that the greater the person, the greater their evil inclination. That's how we that's the first basic explanation. The greater the person, the greater their evil inclination. So Menashe says to Ravashi, look, I'm greater than you, spiritually. I could see God in the details. So therefore, I had a greater temptation in general, and it manifested itself. Say, no, the specific manifestation is corresponding to the specific form of greatness. He was great in spiritual sensitivity, in deriving spiritual pleasure from spiritual experiences. Because of that, he sought out other experiences of spirituality that were less than healthy. Straight up. Make sense? We're not justifying it, but we're putting it in a context where it makes sense. And by the way, the golden calf, they saw God on the mountain. 40 days later, they're dancing around saying, Zelik, this is the God of Israel who took us out of the land of Egypt. You kidding me? The golden calf that you just made is... Looking through these lenses, it all makes sense. They loved Sinai. They wanted to replicate it. They didn't have another revelation. We're going to create a revelation. It's not the true revelation. It's close. It'll get me high. So we're doing it. It's going to come at the detriment of my real experience. But I need this right now. Understand? There's one thing to say that Adam and Eve were great. Because they were great. They had a big yetzer. They had a big temptation. So they sinned. Now we're saying the sin fits with the greatness. They were, the Jews at Sinai saw God. They loved the revelation. They wanted to make more revelation. Let's make us a revelation today, folks. Let's build a calf. That's what they wanted. Not justifying it, but we're understanding it in a context. Yeah. Does this make sense? A little bit at least? Again, this is not the definitive explanation of why it happened, what happened. This is one way to look at it. Is a lot of, and there are a lot of lessons, as we'll see, soon see. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Go ahead. Go.
So would I be guilty of judging Moffat if I asked, it seems that his obsession with spirituality and Adam and Eve's obsession with...
the golden calf, you could say. Yeah, yeah.
The golden calf thing, it's ego-tainted. It's like, you just said, I want to hide.
Correct. Yeah, of course. Doesn't absolve, right? Somebody says, I want a high, so I'm going to get it on my own terms. Of course, that's where the problem lies. Because if you were really concerned with the other, you would follow what the other says. The other says, not now. So fine, not now. So, but I need it now. So you go somewhere else. That's the problem. Yeah, of course that's the problem. That's what I'm saying. I'm not absolving... Here's the thing. We're not absolving Menashe of guilt. He was wrong. But we're understanding the context. We're understanding that it's hard to understand the temptation that he had. It's hard for us to relate to it in the precise terms. It's almost like you have a parent and a child, and the child wonders, how is it that dad could have been unfaithful to mom? To the child, it makes no sense. To the parent can understand. Not that it justifies it, but can have at least some sort of... The child, it makes no sense. Ravashi is the child. Menashe is the father. Menashe is the parent. Or any parent. It doesn't have to be that parent that's actually involved. But a parent understands, can relate to it. Child can't relate to it. Ravashi says, what were you guys doing fooling around with idols? Menashe says, you had to be there. Do you know how good it felt? To have a spiritual experience. Do you know what it means? You don't know what her prophecy is dead. There's no error prophecy. You guys can't relate to God in such intimate terms. You don't know what it feels like. If you don't know the high, you don't know the distortion. Of course it's distortion. Of course it was ego driven, and that was the basis of the fall. True, nachon. Bottom line, yeah. You don't.
So if it's equally balanced, yeah, perfectly, yeah, how can you punish someone
for the choice?
Equally
balanced is, first of all, again, I don't like punishment, but bottom line is there are consequences. Because it's equally balanced, what that means is you could have gone either way. Who made the choice? You didn't have to make the choice. You weren't, this is a major principle, one of the 13 principles of faith. Maimonides writes at length about this. He says, if a person could ever say, I had to do the sin, I had to, I was compelled to do it, then take Torah and rip it up. Take Judaism, throw it away. You know why? Because the whole point of Torah is telling you what you should be doing. If a person could ever say, well, that doesn't apply to me, so what's the point of Torah? We have to say that anytime there's a challenge, there's a corresponding ability to withstand. That's what we mean perfectly, really balanced. And again, it can't be either way. We can't be more slanted that way to the negative or to the positive. It has to be perfectly balanced. And then, that gives the human being the autonomy to actually choose and have that choice be meaningful. But that's vis-a-vis free choice. But getting back to Menashe's perspective, Ravashi doesn't understand Menashe. Just quickly recap, very quickly. Menashe can't relate to Ravashi. Ravashi can't relate to Menashe. Colleague, what were you guys doing? He says, look, you can't understand because you weren't there. What does it mean that you weren't there? You didn't experience the same spiritual high that we had. So either you weren't as great, therefore you don't have the same great negative drive, or more specifically, and to the point, since you don't have the same same pleasure in spiritual experiences, you don't know what it means to seek that in other places that are unhealthy, or to have that temptation at least. You don't know what it means. Like the five-year-old child that can't relate to it. And so, again, far from being, again, a justification, it's all about context. It's all about understanding, at least, that it was a very severe challenge in their time. So where does this leave us? It leaves us, by the way, by no means at all do we tie up every biblical story where we scratch our heads and say, what were they thinking? We spoke about just a few examples. The Jews with the golden calf. We spoke about Adam and Eve. We spoke about the king, Manasseh, and others who served the Baal consistently. We spoke about that vis-a-vis idolatry. Now, what about all the killings and whatnot? We haven't. The attempt is not to explain everything, and we're really not trying to justify, but it's to understand the central point that I said at the beginning we're going to establish, and that is, can't judge. We can't judge, because at the end of the day, in areas that where we have that balance, that perfect balance of the, we also sometimes choose the other way. Maybe it's not as dramatic as the stories that we read about, but the bottom line is the same idea. So now, with all of this, let me see if I covered everything. Fine, and that's why. Sorry, one point that I did, just to finalize. But if you go through the dialogue, we're not going to do it now because we kind of did it. But if you go through the dialogue, the original Talmudic dialogue in Sanhedrin between Menashe and Rav Ashi, you'll see that point for point, it's exactly what we said here from this deeper perspective. It's the law of the bread meaning that you see God. What does that mean? That means that we perceive God. If you perceive God, why did you sin? Why do we sin? Because we perceive God. Either because we're great, therefore we have a great inclination, or because we saw God, we wanted that experience in other places. And then Rav Ashi understands that. The next morning he comes and says to his students, into the study hall, and he says, we're going to commence the lecture with a discussion about the great ones. He calls them great because he realizes that their great temptation comes from their spiritual greatness and their sensitivity. So he calls them the great ones. And that concludes the interpretation of the story. Let's now derive several practical lessons. And this will take us over the next 9 minutes to the end of the class. The practical lesson, again, I said that we're going to have some, I'm going to say now four or five practical takeaways. Number one is the one that I've been mentioning again and again and again. And that is, we cannot judge, bless you, we cannot judge others. Take a look. Oh, by the way, sorry, I forgot to say this. Text 7 on page 102. Melissa, please read this. Text 7 on page 102. This is the explanation that we gave right here in text 7, page 102. Right, that's the explanation. That's what it's based off of right here. It's in the book. I didn't make it up. That was all right. Now that we've established that, that's the practical takeaways. Takeaway number one, we can never judge someone else. Let's look at the words of Deborah, take it away. Take a look at the words of our sages in Avot 9a, page 106. We're skipping some texts. That's good, don't worry, you didn't miss much. Page 106, text 9a.
Do not judge your fellow.
Says it Avot, and this is also in To Kill a Mockingbird. Do not, paraphrase, do not judge your fellow until you've stood in his place. What does that mean? Since you can never stand in someone's place. Why? Because they're occupying that space. Right, try to... It ain't going to work. Yeah, but then they end up moving, and then again you're still not in their place. You're in their old place, but not their new place. Since you can never be in someone else's place, you can never judge. It's a very important lesson. We sit there and we armchair quarterback. Well, they should have done this. I can't believe they did that. Manasseh says to Rav Ashi, give me a break. Respect. He doesn't say that. He says, come on. You weren't there. You don't know what we had. And you don't know what temptations we had that came along with the gifts that we had. You weren't there. You were there, you might have also been running after idolatry. Bottom line is, we can never judge. When you see somebody stumble, it's a practical, you see somebody make a mistake, and you wonder, how could they have done it? How could they have done it? How could they have done it? You don't know what's going on with them. You don't know the temptation that they have. And even if they have the same challenge that you had, and you withstood the challenge, like, I had the opportunity to make a shady business deal and make money, and I didn't. And they did. They're a bad guy, I'm a good guy. Wait a second. You don't know the yetzer, the inclination that they have. Yeah, the opportunity, maybe the identical opportunity presented itself, but the inner makeup, it doesn't mean that we excuse wrong behavior. What it means is that unless our title is judge and we're wearing a black robe, it ain't our job to judge. It's not our job. Our job is to do good things and to help people do more good things around us and to give advice when needed, when necessary, when the other is going to listen. But to judge someone, to start pulling down people and say, oh, I can't believe they did that to the other, cannot judge until we stand in their place. We simply cannot relate to them. And here's an important point that is attached to this. It's especially important when we see great people fall. And it happens all the time. People that are respected leaders in communities, in Jewish communities, in global communities, in political communities, it doesn't make a difference. And we know history tells us, recent history, ancient history, time and time again, we have great people that we look at and we say, how could they have done that? What were they thinking? How could they have fallen? You know what? They were never great. They were never great, and we tear down everything. The message of Menashe is, doesn't mean they were never great. Maybe they were great, and they're still great. But because they're great, they have a correspondingly great temptation toward whatever it was that they fell into. But it's not only the harder they fall, the bigger they are, the more tempted they are to self-destruct. Doesn't mean, I thought they were a respectable person, and now look what I see. Wait a second. Understand that mathematical formula is flawed, based on what we learned tonight. It's not that I thought they were great, and now I saw them do something, it must mean they weren't great. No, it means that they didn't withstand their equally great temptation. That's all it means. It means that they're human. Doesn't mean that they're not great. Doesn't mean that you have to emulate everything that they've done, but it also doesn't mean you have to tear down people. Make sense? It's a very important lesson that we all have to be reminded of, especially because the first nature is when things happen and when people make mistakes and it comes out, first reaction is destroy them. No need to destroy anybody. Menashe told Rav Ashi, no need to destroy me. You can't relate to me. I made a mistake, fine. You don't have to destroy me. Second lesson. Lesson number one, don't judge the other. Don't tear them down either. Second lesson is, if you want to judge somebody, judge yourself. In other words, evoke your inner Rav Ashi against your inner Menashe. Rav Ashi says incredulously to Menashe, what were you thinking? How could you have done it? Perfect. Perfect. When it comes to somebody else, it's not good to ask that question. When it comes to yourself, ask the question and demand change. In other words, ask yourself, how could you have done such a thing? What were you thinking? And then don't give the answer like Menashe gives. Well, you should be here in my shoes. No, you should say, you're right, and I'm not going to do it again. All right, it's a cute idea to judge yourself. Let's do lesson three. Let's move on. Lesson three. And this is such an important lesson in life. Never play the what-if game. Let me explain. So often we think to ourselves, if I only was this, if I only had that, if only I was born to that family, had that education, if I only was gifted in that area, if I had that sensitivity, if I was smart like that or whatever, then I could do great things. You know what the message is? If you were that great, guess what? It would still be hard. Don't think that if I was greater, it would be so easy. Who said it was going to be easy? You're greater, it's going to get even harder. So you know what? If when you're greater, you'll do the right thing even though it's hard. So do it right now. It's always going to be the same choice. Understand the point? Kind of makes sense? I feel like I'm not communicating so clearly. The point is very simple. It's always going to be at balance, so it will always be difficult. Whether you're here and your temptation is here, or whether you're here, so your temptation will be up there. It's like, but we play the what-if game. You know, there's a text here from, what's it called again? From, what is it?
If I were
Yeah, from Fill in the Roof. If I were a rich man, text 11. Right? Charna, take it away, text 11. Whatever. Whatever, however you want. Huh? Now you can just... and you don't have to read the Yabbi Dibbi unless you want to. It's. I'm leaving it up to you. Ball's in your court.
If I were a rich man, Yabbi Dibbi.
Well done.
If I were rich, I'd have the time that I lack to sit in the synagogue and pray and maybe have a seat by the Eastern Wall, and I'd discuss the holy books with the learned men several hours every day. That would be the sweetest thing.
Look what he says. If I had money, then I would have time to study. Really? Why? Who said? You know, maybe if you had more money, you would have more distractions. It would be harder. Bottom line is, it's always going to be difficult. It's always going to be a challenge. Imagine, say, nowadays, think about, let's reverse it. Let's throw back on Menashe. Rav Ashi Menashe. Think about it. I'm not sure why I just did that. But think about this. We tell ourselves in the temple times, they had a temple. They saw miracles. They saw God. So easy. Yeah, some people served idols. I can't understand them. But like, if I was there, I would be the greatest tzaddik. Imagine Rav Ashi thinking that. Like, if I was there, woo, you Menashe, you're corrupt. If I was there, I would be like even superpowered tzaddik. You know what? Doesn't come automatically. We think, you know, if I was around when the temple was built, if I was around at Mount Sinai, I would never sin with the golden calf. Again, first of all, who are we to judge? Second of all, with every great spiritual power comes a correspondingly great negative drive the opposite direction. Point is, there's never going to be a silver bullet that makes things easier. It will always be balanced. And therefore, why push off what you need to do? Do it now where you are. And then, yeah, you should have guilt and you should be able to sit. But you'll have trained yourself to make the positive choices. Make sense? Yes. Okay. Final point. And this is the most sobering point of all. We are never too big to fail. None of us. None of us are too big to fail. You know, that was the line that was in the financial crisis. Some banks were bailed out. They were too big to fail, whatever. We're not going to get into a political discussion. But the bottom line is that as human beings, Torah warns us, cautions us, that there is no such thing as too big to fail. In fact, in the Mishnah in Avot, Howard, read this please, text 12, Mishnah in Avot says, page 108. Even if you're a tzaddik and you've made all the right choices and you're spiritually great, guess what? Lurking there at the door, crouching at the door, is an equally great temptation that could get the better of you, or you, it's not like it happens to you, but you could choose to act on something negative. We're never too big to fail. Even Menashe, who saw God, who had these great spiritual experiences, he made incredibly terrible choices as well. No one is impervious to the temptations. It's always equally balanced, etc. It's the same idea, but just taking on different forms. And by the way, this is also from Avot, this connects with the first point. Because knowing how vulnerable we are as human beings allows us to be less judgmental of other human beings who we see have made negative choices. In other words, understanding that we could easily make a negative choice and fail ourselves makes it easier for us not to judge someone else who has made a negative choice and failed. Because I could do the same thing tomorrow. Today? Tonight's still young, right? Okay. Epilogue. What happens with Menashe? What's the end of the story? Scripture tells us something amazing. He was captured by... Who was he captured by? He was captured by an opposing king. The Assyrian army was battling the Jewish people. They capture Menashe, the king. They have him placed in a cauldron over fire. They're torturing him, they're about to kill him. Comes along Menashe, and he starts davening to Hashem. The same Menashe, the idolater, murderer, he prays to God. What happens? There's a big tumult in the heavens. The angels say to God, "Oh, you're not listening to this guy, are you?" You know what God says? Yeah. Why? Because if not, then the door to tshuva, the door to return, will be shut forever before those who wish to return. Absolutely. The door always has to be open. Let's take a look at text 14. Jay, you want to read it? Page 110, text 14. This is the end of the story.
When Menachem was distressed, he treated his God and humbled himself before the God of his father. Menachem prayed to God and accepted his prayer and he heard his supplication. God returned from Jerusalem to his kingdom, and Menachem knew that the Lord was God. Menachem then removed the foreign gods and the statues of the house of God. All of them that he built until the land and grew. And he cast them outside the city. He built the altar of God. He sacrificed his peace offering, his thanksgiving offering, and instructed the Jews.
This happened after 22 years of his reign. 22 evil years. The last 33 years, he went idol free. No idols. Cut out the idols from the diet.
So, then why does the Mishnah say that he had no place in the world to come?
It's a good question. It seems like although he personally did tshuva, he personally repented, that he caused so much destruction in the world that he wasn't able to undo everything. And because of that, there were still ramifications. Now, who are we to understand what is the world to come, what portion he doesn't have, does he have some sort of... We're by no means the authority. All we know is what this says in Chronicles and Scripture, that he did repent and it was accepted, and he did lead... Built the altar of God, sacrificed the peace offerings, instructed Judah to worship the God of Israel. He did teach and lead in an honorable way for 33 years, the last 33 years of his reign. We also know what the Mishnah says later, that he has no share in the world to come. It's a good question. It's something that I was, certainly I spent time pondering and thinking about. And from what I understand, the best that I can make of it is that, again, there were things that he did that still somehow he wasn't able to rectify. And because of that, there's something outstanding. Does that mean that... I don't know what it means. But aside from that, the epilogue is that it really is never too late for at least the person themselves to turn over a new leaf or a new chapter, whatever the cliche is, and basically to get back to a better place in their life. So the final message then... We have four messages about judging others and other lessons. The final lesson is never write off anybody. Never believe that they're too far gone, whether it's someone else or whether it's ourselves. We always have the ability, if we truly desire and put in the work to rehabilitate ourselves, to get back to a good place, even after we fall. Because in God's world, there's always hope. There's always a second chance. That's it for tonight. Thank you all for coming out. Just to talk about next week very briefly. So next week...